are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
Chuck, what are your thoughts on Matt Joyce? And then if you want to feel free to rant a little bit.
I think I'm permanently off Billy Bean's Christmas list.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Very sneaky, although my Brewers are putrid and they suck. Hope springs eternal and everybody but the A's and the Padres are excited right now.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Put together our show notes prior to kind of the madness breaking on Monday morning and kept adding names and adding names and adding names. And then Knight just finally said, well, fuck it.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Welcome to episode 171 of the Friends of Fantasy Benefits Baseball Podcast. I am Justin Mason, lead fantasy writer and analyst for friendsoffantasybenefits.com. Join with me on this episode is Chuck and Darius. Darius, how you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Just trying to keep up with all these moves going on, the sale madness and everything. But yeah, having fun with it.
Yeah, there are a ton of moves going on. For the most part, I put together our show notes prior to kind of the madness breaking on Monday morning and kept adding names and adding names and adding names. And then I just finally said, well, fuck it. Anything that happens Monday after, we're going to just have to cover the next week because we just got too many things to talk about. Chuck, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I mean, it is nice. Baseball dominates the off season, and it's weeks like this that's why. Hope springs eternal, and everybody but the A's and the Padres are excited right now, probably.
Well, the A's signed someone on this list.
Oh, that is true. How do I forget?
I can't wait to hear Chuck talk about Billy Bean again when we get to Matt Joyce.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm permanently off Billy Bean's Christmas list for Christmas cards. I think that's pretty likely at this point.
I think that is a pretty fair statement. So we are going to talk about a bunch of player moves, and then we're going to discuss a couple players that we weren't able to last time we got together. Because we were having recording issues. Everything seems fine so far with this recording, fingers crossed. But a lot of the player moves, the big ones especially, that have happened either Monday or after that will be discussed on next week's podcast. I didn't want to turn this into a 2-hour podcast or miss out on talking about those players that we wanted to discuss a couple weeks ago when we were last together, us three. So let's jump right in, though, to some of the signings and trades and things that have happened. And let's start with Yoenis Cespedes, who re-signs with the Mets on a 4-year deal. Chuck, what are your thoughts on Cespedes returning to the Mets?
Well, I think I'm going to be the only person you're going to hear say that I'm not very excited about it. They've been relatively cash-strapped, and they're still doling out big money for David Wright. And to me, his upside is somewhat limited between the pitching in that division and the fact that his teammates are pretty much going to stink. Right now, their second-best hitter that we have, actually Duda and Neil Walker both are coming back from shoulder back kind of injuries, and they're not exactly forces within the game. I think Jose Reyes, etc. There's not much surrounding him, and I think that's going to limit his counting numbers greatly, just like his RBIs were limited last year. So everyone else is excited. I think if he'd have gone anywhere else, his fantasy value would have been greater.
Darius, do you agree with Chuck?
Yeah, I kind of do. This Mets lineup has not been that exciting for a while, and Cespedes obviously makes it considerably more exciting, but I agree that around him there isn't an awful lot to get excited about. If Duda and Walker can make it back to near their career best, then maybe it looks a little bit better, but who knows what's happening with David Wright. Curtis Granderson's getting older. I think Jay Bruce, if he sticks around, is on the downswing. So it doesn't look great from that perspective. From a, specific player perspective on Cespedes. I think I like him a lot more than I did a couple of years ago. I think he's improved at the plate in terms of his discipline, his pitch selection. And so I'm kind of more in than I might have been a couple of years ago from in terms of his personal skills. But I do have a lot of concerns about that lineup, and I don't think he's going to be the kind of guy you can count on to play the whole season. I think expecting more like 130 games and then anything on top of that as a bonus is kind of where I'm at with him. So there's definitely skills to like there, but I think that the contextual factors might mean that he's going to be a little too highly priced for me.
Yeah, I completely agree with you guys. And I think if they continue to shop Jay Bruce around like they have been doing and end up moving him, that's going to put a little bit more of a damper on him, though it would give my boy Michael Conforto a place to actually play on this roster. So, you know, I don't mind the signing from a real baseball perspective. They needed Cespedes to come back to make this lineup even halfway decent. But they've got an obvious hole at third base where David Wright's back used to be. Who knows what they're going to get from Lucas Duda. I think Duda to me is a guy that could be a kind of a sneaky, you know, late round first base pick, but you know, who knows what we're actually going to get from this year coming off of back surgery. I don't think I'll pay the price, because I think there's going to be a Mets fan or two in every draft of mine that is going to be willing to pay the money on their savior, Yonis Cespedes.
Well, from a baseball, you know, state of the game perspective, I thought it was very interesting that he has a no trade clause, but he has no opt out clause,
which
most of the recent contracts have included opt out clauses. Something that seemingly maybe the owners are getting away from, because I haven't heard a lot of that so far this offseason. That's one of my pet peeves. I don't like teams adding opt-out clauses, because I think that means they automatically lose the contracts. You know, like the CC Sabathia obviously isn't opting out while he's making $20 million a year when he's a $6 million a year pitcher. So to me, I was happy to see that there was no opt-out clauses either. He's going to be there as long as he wants to be.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Let's move on to the next signing, and that was Carlos Beltran signing with the Astros. I really didn't think this one was going to happen, because there was a lot of talk about Edwin Encarnacion signing with the Astros and them looking at first base options. And then they go and kind of clog up that roster with Carlos Beltran. Chuck, what are your thoughts on Beltran going to the Astros?
Well, I think he's a really interesting late game play. I think he's going to have outfield eligibility in almost every format. And so in the middle of a lineup, until you really put it out on paper, you don't realize how much upside there is in that lineup, and easily the most upside of any lineup within their division, and one of the top three or four lineups in the game. I think he used to be an Astro. I think it probably signifies that he wanted to be an Astro again, now that the team itself has turned the corner. So I actually really like this as a late game play as an outfielder. I really like this signing a lot.
Darius, are you in agreement with Chuck?
Yeah, I love the lineup. If you look at that with Correa and Altuve and Springer, and then the guys they've brought in, to come in further down the lineup with Reddick and McCann and now Beltran, it's really solid from top to bottom. I think there's a huge amount of upside there, and I think they could easily be the best lineup in the American League next year. I have a few concerns about the injuries. I think the way that they've constructed this roster, he's probably still going to have to play a bit in the outfield if they want to get him in the lineup regularly, with the likes of Gattis on the roster as well. So I'll be interested to see how that plays out. I would prefer it if he didn't at all and if he just got to DH, because I think as long as he can do that, he can and stay healthy, then I think he's still a very good hitter. I'm very excited about what the Astros lineup can do in general, and if I can get a piece of it in a late round, then I think that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be some obvious regression next season with Beltran from what his 2016 numbers were. I mean, I just don't buy that he is going to hit almost 30 home runs again in Houston. I love the landing spot, but I think the real life situation that you just brought up, Darius, in terms of where he's going to play, is a real concern for me, at least, because I mean, this guy is going to be 40 years old at the beginning of next season. He's had nagging injury issues the last few years. I don't know if there's a way for him to actually get to 600 plate appearances, which he hasn't done since 2013. So that, to me, kind of limits his value. But I don't think you're going to have to pay anything for him, kind of to Chuck's point, is I think he still kind of ends up being a late-game guy in most drafts. And I think that is worth the gamble, especially in 15-team mixed leagues. To me, he's one of those kind of scenario guys that we were talking about with Tim Heaney, I believe, on the last podcast, in which I don't think I would target him in an AL only, but in a 15-team mix, I think he's a fine kind of late guy to add to your roster. I just don't want to be stuck holding the bag, in a deep AL only if for some reason he does get injured or they have problems kind of getting him out there every day. Let's go ahead and move on and talk about Matt Holliday, who signed with the New York Yankees this week, which I'm sure Matt Thompson is none too pleased about. But I think it's a pretty nice landing spot. Do you agree, Darius?
Yeah, I do. I've always loved Holliday. He's a rare breed, really. He's had an above average OPS plus and WRC plus every single year of his 13-year career. Not many players who can say that. He's been one of the best hitters of the last 10 years, really, when you look at his record. So I have great confidence in his ability, and I think the spot is really nice, as you say. Whether he can actually, again, like Beltran, manage to stay out there for 130, 140 games is a question to me. He's not managed to get anywhere close to that over the last couple of years. And there were a couple of concerning signs in terms of his plate discipline last year, which I'm hopeful were just related to some of those injury issues and that he's been battling. So I think there's a few concerns, but like Beltran, I don't think you're going to have to pay too much for him, and I think he can get a little boost in home runs from being in Yankee Stadium as well. So yeah, I like the deal, and providing that people aren't going to jump all over him, which I don't think they will. For a 37-year-old, people don't usually tend to be that excited about these kind of players. So I think I'll probably own a few shares of Holliday next year.
Chuck, what are your thoughts on Matt Holliday moving to New York?
I'm pretty excited about it, actually. And to put it in context, I think when we have guys like Beltran and Holliday who are going to be eligible at positions, even though they DH, that really deepens the pool of players for us because they're not DH-only types like Kendrys Morales is or you know, Billy Butler was in recent years, etc. And they're viable fantasy options. Matt Holliday obviously moves to the right park for any human that doesn't get moved to Colorado. And so to me, this is a great situation for him. The other thing I really note is that he's not going to struggle for playing time in New York, because I don't think people are really putting together in their head exactly how weak that Yankee lineup is going to be. You know, they really have very few established hitters left anymore on that team. And, you know, you got to try and get stuff out of Brett Gardner's and and Jacoby Ellsbury's of the world, who are trending the wrong way for the most part. So I think it's going to be very interesting, you know, Gregorius and him and Starling Castro and our man, Mr. Sanchez, behind the plate. That's pretty much all that exists of the Bronx Bombers right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things, too, if you look at their bench, you know, the guys who could, you know, quote-unquote, eat into some of his at-bats, you have Austin Romine, Tyler Austin, Ronald Torres, and Aaron Hicks. So, I mean, not guys that I'm really worried about taking away plate appearances at the designated hitter position. You know, I mean, I think the only thing I would think that might hurt his value is I got a feeling that he could get moved pretty easily at the deadline, you know, when the Yankees aren't competing, and so who knows where he ends up there. But this is a guy I think you're going to get for less than $5 in an AL-only league. So, I mean,
that's a great deal.
Yeah, I think there's nothing but upside and profit to be made even if he, I mean, this is a guy who hit 20 home runs in 426 plate appearances last year in a much worse stadium than he's going to be moving to in New York, getting to go to the American League. I love this move for his fantasy value because I don't think anybody will really care that much. And those are the kind of guys I love to pick on, especially in deep mixed leagues or AL only. So he's definitely a guy that will probably end up on a number of my rosters because he's going to be so cheap, there's nothing but profit to be made. And if he doesn't pan out, you pick him up, or you know, you drop and pick him up, pick up someone else. Let's go ahead and move on and talk about Eric Thames, who signed with the Brewers after they non-tendered Chris Carter. So Thames, who's been playing in Korea for like the last 3 years, has just been lighting it up over there. So gets to come back on a 3-year deal with the Brewers. Chuck, you are the Brewer guy. What are your thoughts on Eric Thames now as your starting first baseman?
Well, as a generality, I love the move for the Brewers themselves, because the one thing about Chris Carter is on paper, the plate discipline numbers look a lot better for Thames. And also, reportedly, he can still play both corner outfield positions. So that frees them up to do a number of different things, depending on where and how much they want to play Hernan Perez, if they move Ryan Braun, etc. Very sneaky, although my Brewers are putrid and they suck. The one thing about them is that they've turned out to be a pretty good fantasy option because they really multiply the stolen base numbers for their players as aggressive as they've been on the base paths, and not just the elite guys. You know, Braun's stolen bases jump back up too, and was always known as a speed guy but was trending the wrong way, etc. Miller Park's a good place to hit. I do think that the roster is up and coming enough that although they can't pitch to anyone, and it's too bad that Eric Thames can't hit against Brewer pitching, I still think that there's plenty of upside here, and I think he's probably a $10 to $12 player at least in most mixed leagues because, you know, all the models are – he's breaking all the model systems. Zola and everyone else are really concerned about how to rate him because as they put him through these models that they've built for projections, they can't see him being as good as they're projecting him to be, and I think that's a good sign.
Darius, what are your thoughts on Thames moving to Milwaukee?
Yeah, I'm very interested. I think it's a fun move. I know you're sad about Chris Carter. But,
yes, this is bullshit.
But I think for the Brewers, it's a nice deal. I think he's, you know, probably going to be at least kind of what Carter was, and there's room for a decent amount of upside there. So I like the deal. I think it's a great place for him to hit, like Chuck said. I think particularly good for left-handed power. So I think that's nice. And I don't know what to make of the steals. He was never like a mega speed guy when he was in the minors or in his brief time in the majors previously. So I'm not quite sure what to expect out of him, but I think that at least that shows that he is kind of still mobile. And Chuck mentioned that he can still play the corner outfield, so I think hopefully there's a little bit of upside there as well. So I'm pretty intrigued about this. I'd also like to add that it's really difficult for me to say Thames because this is spelt the same way as the River Thames. And so every time I see his name, I want to say Eric Thames, and
Marcus Thames or whatever his name was, with no relation, but same spelling of the last name. Yeah.
So if I ever say Eric Thames in the future, you know why.
Thames for me is a guy that I'm probably going to avoid because I just feel that people are going to look at those KBO numbers and are going to be willing to go the extra buck or two. Like, I think this is a $8 to $11 player in NL only. And I, you know, if we saw what, like, Park went for last year in AL only, I think he ended up becoming, like, a $15 to $20 player in most drafts based on what we saw from the power numbers coming over from the KBO. And I just, I think Thames is going to get that kind of inflation, and to me, it's just not worth it. It's not worth the risk. I mean, this is a guy who never really sniffed the majors for the most part, and now goes and plays 3 years in what is, you know, largely considered like high A kind of talent over in Korea for the most part. And it crushes them, comes back, and now we're going to say that this guy is worth a fantasy roster. I think if you can get him cheap, if you're playing in a league with guys that really have no idea who he is because they don't follow baseball closely, I think he's the perfect guy, you know, to grab late in the draft. I just don't know how late he's going to go if you're playing with people of your own caliber who are listening to podcasts and reading articles on FanGraphs, looking at, you know, multiple ranks other than just, you know, the main kind of ESPN ones out there. So I think depending on the level of competition in your league will determine his value on draft day. And to me, with the kind of level of competition I tend to play against, I think he's going to go too high for the risk involved for me. Let's go ahead and move on, talk about Derek Norris, who was acquired by the Washington Nationals. This obviously helped shut the door on the Wilson Ramos returning to Washington, and he ended up signing a deal yesterday on Tuesday with the Rays. So, Darius, what are your thoughts on Derek Norris being the starting catcher in Washington?
I think it will be better than 2016 because he was basically the worst qualified hitter in the game. So I don't think he's got too high a bar to clear there. I don't know how much better it's going to be. I noticed that he did have a really low BABIP on line drives, over 100 points lower than the league averages. So I think he did get unlucky, particularly with that really low average. I don't think he's going to be a good batting average guy, but I think the extent to which it dropped was a little bit of a fluke. He's good, takes a decent amount of walks, so I think he'll be okay in OBP leagues, but I don't think he's going to hit high in this lineup at all. I think he's probably batting eighth, so you've got to discount him in terms of plate appearances and his runs and RBI opportunities there. And there were some concerning signs in terms of the fact that his contact rate dropped about 5%, which is a pretty big decline. So it's hard for me to see a situation in which I'm going to be likely to take him. I think there are better bargain catchers I'd rather take a shot on. And unless I'm in a very deep league where it's kind of you just have to own all of the catchers, and I think I'm in one of those with you, Justin, where I probably still have Derek Norris, sadly. So I'll be hoping he bounces back there. But beyond that, it's hard for me to recommend him in many leagues.
Chuck, what are your thoughts on Derek Norris going to Washington?
Well, I'm delighted, and I think that most people are going to have the exact opinion that Darius has. And I like that only in so much as I'm a person who waits and waits and waits at catcher. I'm fine taking one of the last three or four catchers in a two-catcher league. And I do feel like he showed some signs a couple years ago and 3 years back. He had some really nice stretches at the plate. And so I guess I'm hopeful that maybe a change of scenery boost, plus maybe a little attitude boost, being on a team that's actually going to be competitive. I'm hoping that there's enough there to warrant him as, you know, a moderate power, decent, very late second catcher. But I don't think the upside is a whole lot more than that.
I think there's a little bit more upside than maybe you guys do. I love hearing Darius's thought process on him because I think he is going to go super late. I think he will have a rebound. You know, it may not be amazing, but I think he was injured most of last year, and I think that really held him back. You know, helped increase the decrease the contact rate. Definitely probably had an effect on his BABIP. I think he is due for a big bounce back, and even if he doesn't bounce back, you're absolutely paying nothing for him. You know, if he's a $3 to $4 guy in a two catcher NL only, I think that there's nothing but profit to be made there. So, I think he's a great guy if you are planning on punting, you know, in catcher in an NL only. I love like pairing him, with another guy that's cheap, you know, Cameron Rupp, who's a guy that I've talked about on numerous podcasts, is a cheap catching guy that I like, or even pairing him with, a JT Realmuto, you know, a guy who's going to Because both these guys, both him and Realmuto, should give you some pretty decent rate stats as long as as long as Norris kind of rebounds in that department. He's a guy that tends to walk a fair amount, so I expect him to rebound quite a bit as long as he's healthy. And he's, you know, even though he's hitting on the bottom of that Nationals lineup, it's still one of the best lineups in baseball. So there should be plenty of people on base in front of him every time he comes up. And there's going to be good hitters coming up behind him, except for the pitcher in the nine spot. So, I think he's going to be an underrated catcher target in deeper formats for me next year. Let's go ahead and talk about Edinson Volquez, who signed with the Miami Marlins. He's been pretty much an afterthought in virtually every format the last couple years. Does moving to the National League and Miami Stadium help at all, Chuck?
Well, if recent performance is any indication, I would guesstimate that it doesn't help very much. I mean, not only is Volquez coming from a long stint in Kansas City, which is pretty unfriendly for home runs and pretty friendly to pitchers to begin with, when Wei-Yin Chen went from Baltimore to Florida, that didn't seem to help him very much either. The numbers are so bad, so drastically bad on his stat lines in recent years. You know, although he did pitch well enough in the playoffs to help them, that this is a signing that doesn't have me very interested. I can't fathom. He's going to go in the point in the draft where I would rather take young guys with more upside who have just maybe started to touch and they're on their way up, instead of someone like this who appears to be thoroughly on his way down to me.
Darius, thoughts on Volquez?
Yeah, I think he's a deeper league slash pickup if you see early in the season that he does seem to be having a good run of form. All of the context is good to me. I know Chen didn't have the best of moves, but I think going to the NL can't be bad. I think the NL East should be a subpar division again as well, depending on how quickly the Phillies and the Braves develop. But I don't think it's a bad move from that perspective. In terms of the peripherals, they're not very exciting. I think that the defense in the infield is certainly about equivalent to what he had in Kansas City. So I don't think he's getting much there. And I think he's probably losing a bit in the outfield. So I think maybe a slightly positive net move there. And I just think he's a guy where you get a really wide range of outcomes depending on the BABIP, really. He's got quite a high ground ball rate, and I think if he gets a little bit of luck in that department, there are still the peripherals there at times. He can strike guys out when he feels like it. He goes through these waves. So I think there are occasions where you might be able to pick him up and start him for a stretch when he's got some friendly opponents, nice matchups, but... Like Chuck says, I think there are going to be so many other guys that I'd rather take a gamble on, unless I'm in a really deep league or just seen him had a couple of good starts and he's sitting out there in waivers. I don't think I'm going to be picking up Volquez too often.
Yeah, I agree with you guys, which saddens me because I've always been kind of a Volquez guy. I always felt like he, while his production in recent years hasn't been spectacular, up until last year he was a guy that you could still get some quality innings from, he wouldn't kill you really in any department, especially AL only, but it kind of all fell off the wagon last year. He was absolutely atrocious the entire season, had a hard time finding the strike zone plenty of times. His home run rate went up. Could you attribute it to an unusually high BABIP from the last 3 years? Sure, he didn't strain as many guys as he usually does, but I mean, you can obviously see the age starting to an inning starting to wear on Volquez. He's 33 years old, going to be 34 next season, so he's a guy that is needing to learn how to pitch with a little bit reduced velocity. I don't know if he can do it. He's a waiver wire guy for me, even in like a 15 team mixed, a dollar guy in NL only, but he's also one of those guys in NL only that can crush you. And if you have to play him week in and week out, I don't think he's worth going after in NL only. Let's go ahead and talk about John Jay, who signed with the Cubs. Darius, does this signal to you that the Cubs are done with Fowler, or is this just a backup plan and therefore he'll be a fourth outfielder?
Well, that was actually the first thing I wrote down. I almost left it at that. I just wrote fourth outfielder next to his name when you did the list. So and I thought I should put a little bit more down. I think they probably are done with Fowler. I think they want to give Almora a shot in the outfield. And so I think that means that Jay is going to be primarily a bench bat. He's a guy who basically has hit for average in his career and nothing else. He's got 31 home runs and 45 stolen bases in almost 850 games. So that gives you some idea of what he produces in the power speed department. So I find it very hard to believe, unless something else happens in that outfield, whether somebody gets an injury or they decide that the Almora isn't ready, I don't think that I'm going to be interested in Jay in any kind of league, really.
Chuck, what are your thoughts on John Jay signing with the Cubs?
Well, I think the fact that we're all taken to talking about all the other roster ramifications instead of John Jay tells you that, you know, that he's a deep, deep, deep league play, deep roster type of guy. He didn't play a whole lot last year, and he didn't play all that well when he did play. Pretty amazing that Jed Jorko was part of a deal that, you know, that mm-hmm. brought John Jay over there, because Jorko is so much of a better player at this point in his career. No, John Jay has always been a decent outfielder. It's really nice to have bench guys who can play center field. What the Cubs needed with John Jay is beyond me, because, you know, it seems like they like Caesar enough to be a fourth or fifth outfielder. I don't understand the Cubs' propensity to, by and large, benching a lot of their talent. Obviously this means that if they're going to get Jay even regular at bats, that Schwarber's going to have to sit a little bit more, hopefully Jason Hayward sits a little more, but it's hard to sit somebody who's got that much money coming at them. So there's a ton of weird roster ramification things going on with the Cubs right now that I don't completely get. And unfortunately, Justin heard it before the show, so his eyes are rolling into the back of his head right now. But I don't understand the way that they use their roster resources. I think they've now sold low on Soler. They've now diminished and could further diminish Schwarber's value within the marketplace. And $8 million for John Jay, when you could have played Soler more for $4 million, could not make any less sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and you know, and you and I did discuss kind of off the air, you know, a little bit of what we're seeing with the Cubs. And while I agree with you, I think they are mismanaging their assets. At the same time, they have the amount of assets to do that, and so therefore, I don't think that is as big of an issue as maybe you do. They're dealing from strength to go, you know, fill a weakness, which is what I think you do when you're trying to win another championship. And they have a window they're trying to extend right now. So I don't have an issue with that. You know, the John Jay signing, to me, I don't think it signals that they're done with Fowler at all. I think he is the backup plan if they can't re-sign Fowler, because I think Fowler does want the long-term contract, and maybe the Cubs don't want to give up as much as he would request and require. So to me, this is a backup plan. He could platoon with Almora in center, and the scary part to me is, at least from a Cubs perspective, you know, a real baseball Cubs perspective, is do I want him having the strong side of the platoon? If for some reason they can't re-sign Fowler, the Cubs could easily go out and trade for a center fielder, near the deadline, you know, and just kind of have him be a stopgap, because I think that's what he is. I think he is a backup plan, and then if that backup plan is realized, he becomes a stopgap. So in terms of fantasy production, I don't want anything to do with John Jay, because I don't think there's any chance by the beginning of August he is a major part of this team. I could easily see him getting DFA'd or moved. So he's a guy that I think from a real life perspective, he is kind of filling their need right now. but I don't anticipate him being valuable from a fantasy perspective at all this year. Let's go ahead and talk about the last signing that we're going to talk about, and we'll talk about the rest of the signings from this week on Monday's podcast, and that is Matt Joy signing with the Athletics, you know, trying to revive his career in a place where careers sometimes go to die. Darius, what are your thoughts on Matt Joyce signing with the Athletics?
I found Joyce much more interesting than I thought I was going to. I didn't realize how often he walked last year. His walk rate was over 20%, which is pretty insane. He had the lowest swing rate of pitches outside of the zone of anybody in the league with over 250 plate appearances. So he's really sort of honed that eye. It's incredible plate discipline. I really love that. If you're in an OBP league, I think there's definitely some value here. Obviously, you've got to take into account the fact that he is in Oakland, so there is going to be a lot of shuffling around here. I will let Chuck talk a little bit more about Billy Bean and his roster construction. But in terms of Joyce's skill development, I'm very interested here. I don't think you'll have to pay anything for him because I don't think people will have noticed that he had this ridiculous walk rate, because he actually had a really weird year. He played 140 games and he started 48 of them. So he actually had 88 games in which he had a plate appearance off the bench, which is only 8 off the all-time record. Did a little play index earlier because I was quite curious about that. So I don't think he's going to be used quite as extremely as the Pirates did this year with him as a pinch hitter. But I think, yeah, there might be something here. I'm going to be very interested to see how he gets on early next year. And I think you can probably pick him up for free off waivers, because I'm pretty sure that hardly anybody is going to have noticed what Joyce did as a sort of mostly pinch hitter in 2016.
Chuck, what are your thoughts on Matt Joyce? And then if you want to feel free to rant a little bit, go ahead.
Wow, you guys seem like you're almost looking forward to it. I can hardly stomach myself. I rant so much on this subject. You know, Joyce is a guy that we don't talk about daily transaction leagues very often, because I don't know what the percentage of daily transaction leagues are, but I'm actually in a couple of daily transaction leagues. And I'm in an OBP league, but one that has weekly roster settings. So his value definitely varies by format, because he's largely, for most of his career, has been hidden against, you know, one side of the pitchers, because he's known as a, you know, a guy who destroys righties. So it's just going to be, it's going to be curious to see how it plays out. From a historical perspective, this isn't a whole lot different than the Seth Smith signing was, meaning that Billy Bean likes to acquire pieces that he can borrow for 2/3 of a season and then trade them for a bag of chips, a soda machine, and something to help fix his sewage problems. It's a very tough thing for me to get excited about. But at the same time, he's proven to be a streaky enough hitter with just enough skills at the plate when he's used the right way that, you know, as an emergency fill-in for a few weeks, he's somebody that you can't completely ignore.
Yeah, this is like the perfect guy for DFS for me. Like, Matt Joyce is a guy that I will be using all the time in DFS against right-handed pitching. You know, right now Roster Resource has him batting 5th in that Oakland lineup, which, you know, isn't good at all, but it isn't as bad as you may think. I mean, you know, it depends on what you think of Ryan Healy. You know, can Jed Lowry stay healthy? You know, will Marc Semien continue to, show some power and at least drive Matt Joyce in? I don't think it's necessarily an atrocious lineup. It's not good by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it might even be a tad bit underrated. I think Joyce for me is, you know, he's definitely a DFS guy, and I think he's a cheap bet in AL only leagues. I think this is a guy that will probably get more than a platoon worthy share of the at bats in right field in Oakland. I think you're right, Chuck. I think he's a guy that could potentially get moved at some point, but that'll only happen if he kind of claims some of his value that we've seen. Like Darius pointed out, I mean, he didn't even get 300 plate appearances last season, hit 13 home runs in that, so with a 20% walk rate. Now, you know, some of those numbers are obviously going to come down, but if he can kind of rebound to some of the value we saw, you know, in like 2012, 2013 when he was on the Rays and people thought he was starting to break out. I think this is a guy that has some serious value in AL only OBP formats for this season. So, and I think he's a guy that probably won't go for more than $3 or $4 in an AL only league.
Yeah, to Chuck's point about format as well, most of my leagues are both OBP and have daily transactions, so I think that's why I'm probably quite excited about him, because I can see myself in a few spots,
and
especially
I think,
when they're going to be facing a lot of righties.
I think most people are listening to a podcast like this, play in a deeper format, play in daily transaction leagues. I think it's much more common with the experienced level players. So, and probably play an OBP, you know, most of the, you know, kind of upper level talent leagues are moving towards OBP in the last, you know, decade. So, I think he is a good guy, especially, like I said, if you're playing an AL only, I think he's going to be on my target list for next season. All right, let's start talking about some guys now that we weren't able to get to last week that I know Chuck in particular is excited to talk about a couple of them. Because it gives him another chance to rant on the A's. Let's start with D. Gordon, who lost the majority of his season to a steroid or a PED suspension. But, you know, he's a guy that should rebound. And I think a lot of his value has been depressed because he lost so much time last year, still stole 30 bases. Chuck, why don't we start with you? What are your thoughts on D. Gordon for next year?
I think his value has been sky high in recent years because he had very close to Billy Hamilton style speed and he was carrying a very high batting average. Now, last year, his season was interrupted by the suspension, and these players know about the suspension weeks before it's announced, which is one of the oddest twists in this, the way this, you know, this drug, this PED policy works. So all of a sudden, you know, like right before Chris Colabello's PED thing was, you know, announced too, all of a sudden he took this dramatic tank like you wouldn't believe. Like, you know, it definitely plays on them. So you really have to make a decision on how you feel about last year's down year for D. Gordon. You know, is this a blip in the radar? This was just, you know, some kind of a training supplement style mistake, and he's going to be fine now. The fact that he was relatively useless for large stretches of the season last year, and, you know, even when he was playing, really frightens me, because when you draft somebody solely on those two things, if you think either of those things are a serious gamble, I really have a tendency to downgrade and look for my speed later. You know you're not getting much power. So to me, the mock drafts that I've seen have him going way too high for my liking. You know, I was expecting
where,
him to fall.
Where have you been seeing him going? Because, I mean, he went, I want to say, I can look it up, but I want to say he went to me in like the seventh round of a 15-team league in that mock draft that we had with a bunch of industry guys. And if he's going, to me, if he's going after the fourth round in a 15-team league, I think that's nice value.
I mean, there's certainly upside. And for players, you know, I play a lot of poker. And for you know, people, some people enjoy risk and some people don't like risk. And I really don't like risk in my upper-level picks. I've seen him go late in the third and middle of the fourth. And both of those spots are too high for me. If the need fell the right way where you got him, I'm okay with. I have a feeling that he's going to go higher than that in most spots, which I am not comfortable with right now. I mean, it was always, you know, when people were taking him in the second round, et cetera, because, you know, he was on fire coming off batting titles and, you know, ripping up the base pass, something never felt right to me. It just seemed like he's not the kind of skill set that should be able to be taken there to begin with such limited power, basically no power upside. And so I'm just struggling with the idea that one of the first four people I'm going to take in one of my drafts is a guy that I have some cloudiness about the only two skills he really brings.
Darius, what are your thoughts on D. Gordon for next season?
Yeah, I kind of agree in terms of the value. I think if he is going where Chuck says he's seen him going there, that's too high for me as well. The spot you got him in sounds good to me. That sounds like a decent value, and I'd be happy to take him there. But we come back to the OBP again. I think unless he's going to hit for a high batting average, and I don't know whether he will sustain that or not. I've always had questions about his ability to hit. And let's not forget that this was a guy for a long time was kind of the same as Billy Hamilton. Everyone said, well, he's got speed, but he's just going to get the bat knocked out of his hands. And then suddenly he managed to find his way into those high batting average seasons. But I've still always had those lingering questions at the back of my mind about his long-term viability of hitting 290, 300. And, of course, the power hole is a big concern, especially now where you've got a situation with all these middle infielders who are hitting 20-plus home runs. If I'm getting D. Gordon and I can't even expect five, then that's something that I've got to make up big time later in the draft. And I don't really like that. Like Chuck, I think that puts you behind, especially if you've got to take him in the fourth round. So I don't think that I'm likely to get Gordon unless he is, like you said, ending up in the seventh round of a 15-teamer. That sounds like a decent value to me. But if I've got to take him with one of my first three or four picks, then I think I'm out.
And I've got to correct myself. I actually got him in the fourth round of that 15-team. That 15-team mock draft, which I think is at the top end of where I would be willing to take him. I think at this point, I think I'd be more willing to move on him after the fourth round, somewhere in the fifth or sixth round. But I don't have any issues. I mean, he still stole 30 bases last year in 79 games, and so you know, I know power is. You know, it was on the rise last year. If we're entering another juiced ball era of some sort, you know, we could be seeing, you know, speed taking on a premium. I think the fact that he was able to come back and be productive at the end of the season, you know, even with a little bit of rust, I think that was a very, very good sign. I'm not worried about D. Gordon. Now, I'm not going to take him in the second or third round, but I think in the fifth, sixth round, I think he is a nice little value. And I don't even mind taking him in the fourth the way I did in that mock draft. So I think I'm a little bit higher on him. I know there is something to be said for the fact that he has pretty much no power whatsoever to his game, and that means you have to make that up early. But this is a guy that you will game plan around because I think his value in the speed department is that great. So I think I disagree with you guys on where I'd be willing to take him. But that's okay. I'm fine taking the gamble on him. Let's talk about a guy who was going high for the last few years and then completely fell off the map last season due to some injury issues. That's Sonny Gray of the Oakland Athletics. Darius, what are your thoughts on Sonny Gray? Can he rebound?
I think he has to rebound somewhat. I just don't see him being that bad again. Having said that, this was a guy who I was nowhere near taking last year. A couple of seasons of the incredibly low BABIPs. I just thought, I don't care what kind of skills he's got that might run a slightly lower than usual BABIP. There was no way that he was going to maintain the kind of numbers that got him to where he was in 2015. So I was well out on taking him last year, and fortunately that turned out quite nicely. But I do think that a lot of his struggles were related to the injuries he dealt with. He had trapezius and arm strains. He was on the DL multiple times. I think they contributed to his control problems, which in the past have been very good. So I think we can see a bounce back here. And I think he got basically everything that could go wrong in 2016 did go wrong to sort of counteract his previous years. But I would hope that people are not going to expect anything near 2015. I've yet to see where he's kind of been ending up in drafts. So if I can take a mid to late round shot on Gray, then I think I still believe that he's got the talent to be that kind of pitcher. But I think he was kind of back end of the top 100 in drafts last year, and that's way too high for me.
Chuck, what are your thoughts on Sonny Gray for next season?
Well, I'm going to look at it from a bit of a different perspective. You know, he was a very unorthodox pitching prospect because he was so much shorter than the major league average, and he doesn't pitch on that downward plane. And so when these guys who do it differently, when they fall off, it seems to me like they fall off hard. You know, Tim Lincecum certainly comes to mind as a guy who basically, when he started to fall off, he fell off the planet. I mean, it was so hard to watch him try and pitch last year as an Angel. And I don't know that we're quite to that point yet, but my question about Gray is going to be, you know, is he still going to get taken so high that there's not other gambles that I like more? And I still think there's going to be gambles that I like more than what I have here. You know, the old edict says that you never draft for wins. You know, you just don't draft for them. Well, after about the last 5 years of getting stuck with players with, you know, 7 and 8 wins and, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16 losses. I had Archer last year who almost lost 20 games. I've come to try and, as a tiebreaker, use people who I think are in better situations to win games. And while the A's do have some offensive ability, they also a couple. They're a Steven Vogt and, you know, an injury to their Lowry and a trade away from being dramatically terrible, too, since there's not a lot of depth there. And they haven't won a lot of games in recent years. So there's just too much working against Sonny Gray. He's one of those guys I'm not going to blame anybody else taking a chance on, because he certainly could bounce back. If he's 3/4 of what he used to be, he's going to be undrafted. He's going to be underdrafted this year. But I choose to take my gambles on higher upside plays than what I see here.
Yeah, you went 140th overall in the mock draft we had. Obviously, Phil Nassens thought he is a bounce back candidate. I do not. I was very scared last year when the injuries started popping up. I likened it to Tim Lincecum on the podcast last season. So I'm right there with you, Chuck. And to me, this is indicative of a small pitcher who's thrown a ton of innings, in a row. And I think he is starting to break down even just a little bit sooner than we saw with Tim Lincecum. To me, he's a guy who's going to have to prove it. He doesn't have the strikeout upside for me to take the gamble on, no matter where he's going. So to me, he's going to have to prove it. I'm going to be out on Sonny Gray completely this year. And if he rebounds, then for 2018, maybe I'll buy back in. But I just don't think he has the upside from the overall package that warrants taking him as a gamble when other gambles that'll probably be going later will be available to me. I'd much rather have a Berrios than Sonny Gray on my roster at the end of a draft, because I think I'll have paid less for him, and I think the upside's greater anyways. Let's talk about the last guy we're going to talk about on this podcast. That is Matt Harvey, coming off of the thoracic outlet surgery. Horrible year last year. Chuck, I know you have some pretty strong feelings on this guy for next season, so what are they?
Well, he's a very unique case because most of the pitchers that we have any history of coming back from this surgery are quite a bit older than he is, and had quite a bit more mileage going in. But you know, Chris Carpenter first of the Blue Jays way back, and then of the Cardinals for years, is one of the most noted cases in recent years, and he never really thoroughly recovered, but he was quite a bit older. The success stories are pretty limited, and they're only for a couple years. So I think his Dynasty League value takes a really significant hit for this. And I also really want to note, and I'm really interested if you guys agree with me, but I hear a lot of people acting like Tyson Ross is basically done. And he's had the same procedure that Matt Harvey had. And everyone's acting like Matt Harvey. Oh, well, he's going to be fine in the spring. I'm kind of at a loss, really, about the reaction that people are having to this. They're simply acting like, oh, he's going to be back. He's going to be Matt Harvey. And the history of thoracic outlet surgery does not say that that's going to be the case at all. He could have as many problems recovering control as Tommy John you know, recoveries have. That certainly seems to be more like the norm than the exception. So I know he's younger, and I know people love his talent, and I love his talent as well. But if he's getting drafted as, you know, an $18, $19, $20 pitcher that I haven't seen pitch off a procedure like this, somebody is more than welcome to gamble, and I want absolutely nothing to do with it.
Darius, what are your thoughts on Harvey for 2017?
Yeah, I'm pretty concerned too. I mean, this is a condition that can cause some serious shoulder pain, and it can cause you to lose feeling in your fingers. And I think Harvey was definitely experiencing the latter before he had his season end in 2016. And I think he was missing his spots as a result. I think he wasn't able to throw pitches the way he wanted them to because he actually couldn't feel the ball the way that he was used to. I want to see it, really. If we can see that he's back and he's throwing the pitches where he wants to throw them, and you know, the velocity is back up and the control and the command seems to be there, then I'll be greatly reassured. But it's definitely something, as Chuck well highlighted there, there's no one path here. It's not a highly dependable recovery, and you can't just say he's going to come back and he's going to be the same, because I think it's something that's, it's pretty common for people to have recurring symptoms, and surgery doesn't always fix it completely. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be concerned here. And if I can get the opportunity, even if it's just in spring training, to see a couple of starts, to see how he's looking and whether he's happy with how he's throwing, and whether it seems like he's getting the ball where it needs to be going, then that will reassure me a lot. But for now, I think I'm going to stay away unless the price is extremely low.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's going to depend on the price. And I think a lot of it to me is he's supposed to be ready for spring training, so we'll get to see him pitch in spring training. I want to see what he looks like. I mean, all pitchers in this day and age have injury risk. So I know that Chuck tries to stay away from injury risk guys, but I think that's pretty much, you know, every pitcher in the major leagues at this point. So I'm not necessarily as worried about that if he looks healthy coming in. If he looks healthy in spring training, if he's throwing the ball well, if he looks like the same old Matt Harvey, then I'm going to be in. But so will the rest of the industry, and that'll drive up his price. But if he looks bad, I'm probably going to be out. I don't think I'll have a ton of shares this year, because I think, like I said, if for some reason he looks really good in spring training, I think everybody's going to be jumping on him. That's going to drive up his price above guys that I really like in Marcus Stroman and Garrett Cole that are going to have depressed values coming into this season anyway. So probably won't end up with a ton of shares of Matt Harvey, but it's definitely a guy to watch as pitchers and catchers report and he starts to pitch in front of cameras.
I would just like to mention that I think spring training, the one thing about it is, unless your draft is really late, the pitchers start only going through the lineup, you know, a time or two, and they're not playing against premium lineups for very long. Okay. And then on top of it, you're going to be watching like 14 different pitchers to see how they're pitching in spring training this year. So it's going to be a little different than normal. And you're going to add on top of that all the people that are pitching in the World Baseball Classic and then are trying to mesh back into their normal routine. So I think we're going to find out that gauging pitching is going to be trickier than it's almost ever been this year, because, you know, you're going to have Carlos Carrasco to see how he looks. You're going to have Salazar to see how he looks. You're going to have Steven Matz to see how he looks. You're going to have, you know, the list just goes on and on and on. And, you know, that's all fine and well and good. I just think that you're going to have to pick and choose your spots where you want to take gambles on. And I don't think you're going to know how healthy Matt Harvey is until the last week and a half of spring training.
I think those are fair criticisms. I will say, you know, Alex Cobb did have this surgery in 2011, was able to rebound with some nice years before once again having to get Tommy John surgery. So, you know, I mean, there while the history isn't great for thoracic outlet surgery victims, there are a couple bright spots out there. So.
Yeah, I think this is all about timing, really, to Chuck's point. I do not want to be drafting the day after Harvey has a spring training start and looks good I think at that point it's almost not going to be worth doing it. But, you know, if there's a couple of shaky signs early on, if a news story comes out saying he's not feeling right and you're drafting the next day and I'm in a shallow league and I can, you know, suddenly there's a 3 or 4 round discount, then that might actually be a good time to take him. But
I think format depends a lot on this as well, because like Chuck plays in a lot of NFBC leagues that are draft and hold. You know, and in league formats like that, I don't think you can afford to take a guy like this, especially if you're doing one of their slow drafts where you're having to draft in January and February. I just don't think you can take the risk in those kind of formats. But if you're drafting the week before the start of the season, you'll have had a decent sample size of pitches in spring training to gauge what you think his value is and whether or not he can stay healthy for 2017. So I think it depends largely on when you draft, what your format is, and then what his price is. Like I said, if he goes out and is firing bullets all throughout spring training, everybody's going to start drafting him way earlier than he should. He went in, I believe, the eighth round of the draft of the mock draft I was in last month, or actually I think it was more end of October. That to me is too high, you know, at this point. I mean, he went ahead of Lance McCullers, another injury guy, but ahead of Kent Maeda, ahead of Marcus Stroman, I believe ahead of Garrett Cole. So, I mean, you know, that to me is too high, but and he'll probably price will only raise if he's looking good. So I think it's you got to determine what your risk level is before taking a chance on a guy like Matt Harvey. That is going to wrap us up. Chuck, why don't you tell people where you can be reached and what you're working on?
All right. Well, I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. I enjoy Twitter interactions a great deal, and I follow Twitter every day. So feel free to fire any questions at me that you might want my opinion on. I'm working on a piece about divisional evaluations. You know, the things we say about divisions being strong in this area and weak in that area. And I'm going to cross-compare the strengths of the divisions before and after the winter meetings, something that I'll probably share with both Friends with Fantasy Benefits and Banished to the Pen. So I've been hard at that and enjoying it. So hopefully that's a piece you guys can look for.
Darius, what are you working on? Where can you be reached on Twitter?
So you can find me on Twitter at DariusA64. We just had a fun piece on the topic of Chris Sale go up at Banished to the Pen, where one of our writers, Brandon Lee, sort of fielded trade offers for Sale, and we all got involved and tried to submit one. I did sort of a bit of a joke one on behalf of the Giants because I didn't think there was actually anything we could offer that would get it done. So that was a fun one. I've got one going up on tomorrow, hopefully, about John Smoltz and his incredible undefeated streak of 73 wins. So that's an interesting little record to look out for. And then I'm working on the piece for Friends of Fantasy Benefits with this league that I'm doing with Matt, this score sheet league, which is ridiculous. You can't believe the level of detail they've gotten to. They've got winter meetings, free agency bidding, rule 5 drafts, the whole lot. I think it might be harder than actually learning the rules of real MLB. So I'm kind of doing that in the lens of how to get involved with the new league. I won't go too in depth on the specifics of that one, but I'm kind of using it as a way to get into how you should approach starting a new league. So yeah, look out for all of those.
Yeah, I'm in a league like that has, like, we're about to start the Rule 5 draft in this 30-team league with 100 roster spots. I mean, we're rostering A-ball guys and things like that. And it actually ruins my life, like, at points. And it's the most active in the times when the other leagues aren't active at all. Like, right now, it is extremely active. I've made, like, 6 trades in the last, like, 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting emails off these guys, like, every day.
I get 5 to 10 emails a day from people, and it's absolutely ridiculous. But it's one of those leagues, like, one, like, I have to pay attention. I get to pay attention in the off season, which, you know, while the other leagues are pretty much dormant, it gives me an opportunity to kind of have something to do. And then also it forces me to learn all these single A player names, you know, that I've, you know, drafted and picked up. And so I like it for that reason. But yes, it can be the bane of my existence at times. You can reach me on Twitter at Justin Mason FWFB. Email me or the show, friendsoffantasybenefits@gmail.com. Definitely give us a rate and review on iTunes. Definitely helps us out quite a bit. We've got a lot of stuff coming up for the new year. Daily podcasts coming back. We're going to do 30 individual team previews, in which we'll kind of pair off and tackle each team individually for next season. It's lots of great stuff. Bringing in new podcasters, new writers. Friends of Fantasy Benefits is blowing up for 2017, so I really hope you join us for all of that. Definitely check out everything I write for baseball on FanGraphs, and then things I write for football and baseball on friendsoffantasybenefits.com. That will wrap us up. For Chuck, Darius, and myself, thank you for listening. Have a fantastic baseball off season.